It's time now for another Golf Today Roundtable as we welcome in Todd Lewis and Rex Hager. And Rex, you and I were tuned into the television yesterday watching the CJ Cup, Byron Nelson. What was the biggest takeaway from what you saw at the Nelson?
Wyndham Clark with a final nine of 28, just to kind of pull away from the field. I don't think either one of us anticipated that outcome when you consider that all the conversation was about Siwoo Kim. Could he pull it off? Could he do this against his good friend Scottie Scheffler in the final round? Could Scottie Scheffler sort of refine that magic that we've all been talking about? Why hasn't he won? Why hasn't he won? And it's Wyndham Clark that ends up winning in a landslide, pulling away really in an impressive style. I will say, when you look at the ebb and flow of his career, and you guys were just sort of touching on it, I'm fascinated by Wyndham Clark, because here's a guy, this is Wyndham Clark 3.0, is what I would say. I mean, he reinvented himself and got through a lot of really difficult times in college. He had to do it again as a professional, and now it seems like he's done it for the third time.
T. Lou, we speak to these athletes in good times and in bad. This is someone who kind of fell on his sword yesterday. He brought up Oakmont in the aftermath of the victory and him destroying that locker. He thanked every sponsor for sticking with him. How do you view how he has handled this return to the winner's circle?
With someone who, when you think about Wyndham Clark, first off, he's got tremendous talent, especially tee to green. But hearing what he said yesterday shows that he has tremendous maturity. He's taken inventory of where he is mentally and emotionally. And that's kind of been his MO over the last 4 to 5 years. He has talent, like I mentioned. I think the space between his ears has been his biggest challenge. And look, I heard you and Damon, or you and Lav talking about what he did last year. And yes, they were not things that he should be proud of. And for him owning that, that's wonderful. But it does show fire. It does show intensity. And if he didn't have that, then maybe he wasn't a major champion. I don't know if necessarily we should ridicule him or define him for those moments. I mean, let's not forget Tiger Woods. I mean, he would drop some F-bombs out that our mics would pick up during the broadcast. Rory McIlroy threw a 3-iron into a lake of Doral. We all have these moments. Golf can be maddening, but if he does take responsibility and tries to grow from it, learn from it, then I commend him for doing that. I think Wyndham Clark is a very intelligent, grounded player. I think he, like I said, is maturing into a better mental player. And given his talent, if he can get everything synced up consistently, he could be a really big threat and have citizenship in the top 10 in the world.
Rex, one of the big stories on Sunday at the Nelson was the plight of Blades Brown, who locked up special temporary membership, meaning he can receive a limited number of sponsor exemptions on the PGA Tour for the remainder of the season. However, he's also 13th on the Korn Ferry Tour standings, with the top 20 earning PGA Tour cards for 2027. So which route should he take? Should he continue to dabble on the PGA Tour and Korn Ferry Tour? Should he go full-time on the PGA Tour? Or should he commit himself fully to the Korn Ferry Tour? What do you think?
I think any of us who have gray hair would sit here and all agree that, yes, he should focus on the Korn Ferry Tour. This is going to be what's best for his career, just not in the short term, to earn a PGA Tour card this year, which he is going to do if he focuses on the Korn Ferry Tour, but to learn how to be a professional. He talked about that this week at the Nelson, the idea that he learned a lot playing Korn Ferry Tour events over the last year and a half or so about you need to go low. You learned how to travel. You learned how to be a professional. All of these things are going to help him when he eventually makes it on to the PGA Tour. Now, saying that, I have a son that's right about Blades Brown's age, and I know that they normally don't listen, that 19-year-olds don't want to hear, yes, spend a couple months on the Korn Ferry Tour, that'll get you to the PGA Tour. But I think anybody would look at this objectively and say, that's your best path to the big leagues.
T. Lou, what do you think? Because this is a player, we've both interviewed him. He is mature, yeah. I think, beyond his years. He's someone who skipped college, and in his remarks, he's thanked the Korn Ferry Tour for showing him how to be a professional, for showing him how to go low. Should he continue maybe taking this road less traveled as this super team?
Well, that's a great question. First off, he's validated his choice to skip college and go right into the professional ranks, just like Akshay Bhatia has done. And now Akshay's multiple winner on the PGA Tour. So yes, obviously he has the talent. And as Rex was pointing out, he has to grow into being a professional. I agree with Rex. I think his smartest bet is to go back and play at least over the next month or so on the Korn Ferry Tour, secure that top 20 status at the end of the season, which looks like he can do with a little bit of effort, not a lot of effort. However, However, if he gets an opportunity on the PGA Tour in a signature event, now a lot of people don't know this, but if you're a special temporary member, you can receive a signature event sponsor's exemption. Now, I'm sure the Memorial probably has their sponsor invites already out for next week. But Travelers, hello, hey, are you paying attention? Travelers historically has given these young players an opportunity to come play their tournament. If the Travelers offers a sponsoring exemption to Blaze Brown should be smart to take it.
Rex, moving along to a different storyline. This was reported by Amy Lynch, our colleague. The PGA Tour is potentially going to be strongly discouraging or outright banning players who are in this Tier 1 category. Think of the signature events in the PGA Tour from dropping down and playing in the Tier 2 tournaments. So this could affect players like Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth, at the Byron Nelson, trying to support their hometown tournament. What should the PGA Tour do in this respect? Is it okay if they're banning them, or should they be allowed to coast back and forth?
This feels like a devil in the details kind of situation, because I'm sure Brian Rolat never really factored in the idea that some of his stars wouldn't want to play in a Tier 1 event, that maybe they want to go play a Tier 2 event. And then this scenario, we're assuming that maybe the Nelson or the Colonial this week at the Charles Schwab is going to be a Tier 2 event. And all of the players that live here in Dallas would rather play that than maybe next week at the Memorial. I think it's going to be interesting because every PGA Tour player has a fifth major, and I'm not talking about the Players' Championship. Every Tour player has an event that's special to them. For Scottie Scheffler, it was the Nelson. That's why last year's victory there was so important. It was so special to him. Every player has their Nelson that they want to play. So it's going to be tough for Brian Rolap and the PGA Tour to draw such a hard line. I understand where they're coming from. They want to be able to guarantee top fields at these Tier 1 events. But if you have a player that's always just loved to play, and I'm just going to pick an event out of nowhere, the RSM Classic, because that's where he lives and that's where his loyalty lies, it's going to be hard to tell him, no, he can't do that.
What do you think, T. Lou? Should there be a hometown exemption for a Tier 1 player? If you're a Tier 1 level player, maybe you get to have one or two home games or special fifth majors, as it were. Your thoughts?
Well, as the PGA Tour continues to formulate this new schedule with Track 1 or Tier 1 and Tier 2 or Track 2, they've created this issue. But from what I am hearing, what we all are hearing, and how this is starting to formulate for what looks to be in 2028, I'm actually going to respectfully disagree with my friend Rex Hoggard. I think that, yes, if players are going to be set up with what looks to be 16 Track 1 events, at least that, and then you have the playoffs and then you have major championships, we're looking at 20 to 22 events that the PGA Tour is going to have in Track 1. They are going to these title sponsors, these potential title sponsors, and saying, we need $30 million annually. So those sponsors are going to think, hey, I'm thinking about giving you the money, but I want to have the best field. And, you know, Scottie Scheffler wants to skip, like he did the Truist Championship, to play the Byron Nelson. I mean, from a business perspective, that is very, very challenging for the PGA Tour. So I understand the sentiment here. But from a business perspective and trying to put this new system together, we can argue if this is correct or not. That's a different argument. But from what they are modeling right now, I think that this is the right thing for the PGA to do to at least discourage players from going down to Track 2 or Tier 2 and stay on that Track 1 level.
Thank you, T. Lou. I schooled Rex on this very topic last night on the pod show, and glad to see that you're the voice of reason here. Rex, I thought it was very interesting that players at the PGA Championship were griping that the setup was causing some of the scoring to be too bunched. And last week, fans seemingly were disappointed because the scoring was too good. It was too low, and they had a winning score once again at 30 under par. If you're the PGA Tour, how do you try to strike the right balance between setting up a golf tournament that's interesting and trying to set up a golf tournament that's the best competition and the best test for the best players in the world?
I just think this is the ebb and flow of the PGA Tour season. 9 under par won the PGA Championship and 30-something won last week at the Nelson. We're at the Colonial this week. It's a tough golf course. The wind's going to come up, which didn't happen last week. It's probably going to be somewhere in the middle of those two things. I think both things can be entertaining. I don't think this is any reason for the PGA Tour or the PGA of America to get upset about, because you're going to present them with the best test you possibly can. That happened at Aronimink last week. It happened at TPC Craig Ranch, where they had no wind. They had a lot of rain. It was soft. They were playing lift clean in place. When you give those players, the best players in the world, those type of opportunities, they're going to make the most of it. And I will tell both Lav and T-Lou, you guys are completely wrong. You cannot tell a tour player where he can play.
Yeah, we'll see how that all works out as we continue to learn more about this competition committee with the PGA Tour. Speaking of competition, T-Lou, your thoughts on the returning member program, Brooks Koepka deciding not to play this week at Colonial. Big picture, you know, has it been a win for Brooks and the PGA Tour having him back? Is it still kind of, let's wait and see how the year unfolds? Your thoughts on the early months of Brooks Koepka's return and the program as a whole?
Yeah, well, I mean, we still have a lot of season left on the PGA Tour, but there's two things we can talk about here. First, from a Brooks Koepka perspective, obviously he recognized that he is a better player competitor on the PGA Tour compared to LIV Golf. He made the necessary steps, and hats off to LIV Golf for letting him out of his contract and to come out and be a part of the PGA Tour. So for him to come back to the PGA Tour, obviously show humility and appreciation to be back on this tour, I think that's a very positive for him. He has been pretty much welcomed back from everyone I've seen. I've heard no grumblings, and guys, you can tell me if I'm wrong. And in regards to Brooks Koepka returning to the tour from the members. And I think a lot of that has to do with, again, the humility and the appreciation that he has. Secondly, from the PGA Tour perspective, I think they handled this beautifully. I think, and we talked about this when this was happening in February, this was wonderfully done. Wonderfully done by the PGA Tour, not only to welcome Brooks Koepka back, but also kind of open the window and kind of dangle the carrot to those other players who had an opportunity to come back as well. But yeah, I think so far it's been a win-win for both the Tour and for Brooks Koepka.
Rex, from the PGA Tour to the PGA of America, Don Rae is out as president of the PGA, ending his term about 6 months early. It's the third time in the last seven presidencies for the PGA of America that there's been some sort of issue. What lessons do you think that they could learn from a Don Rae presidency?
Lav, I think you're setting me up. I'm in the PGA of America headquarters right now in Frisco, Texas, so I'm going to have to keep my voice down when I answer this particular question. But we addressed this morning, and it's a shame. I feel bad for the 30,000 members of the PGA of America on this front. And really, when you look at what has transpired over the last, you pointed out, 7 years, starting with Ted Bishop and him being removed from office before the end of his presidency, and now this. And I think what's going to have to happen, and the PGA Tour embraced this over the last few years. Now, they were pushed to it by LIV Golf, but there is a governance idea here that they're going to have to address exactly how this organization is run. I'm talking about the PGA of America, because this is what our friend Eamon Lenz called a very sloppy democracy. And that's absolutely right. You have 22 board members, you have executive committee members, there's too many voices, there's too many cooks in the kitchen. And what you end up with is mistakes like we ended up having last year at Bethpage during the Ryder Cup. It's a shame that all of those 30,000 members have to put up with this, because they are the people that are on the front line. Every time I walk into my club, it's my club professional who greets me, who's the one that makes me feel welcome at the golf course. And that happens all over America. So I just feel bad for those 30,000 members.
T-Lou, speaking of golf and governance, LIV Golf shopping itself as a more streamlined product for 2027 and beyond, a shorter schedule. Do you think that there is a viable path forward for LIV Golf next year without funding from Saudi Arabia?
Well, this may come as a shock to you, Dave, and I did not graduate from the Harvard Business School, so I don't necessarily understand the global market, but I have been witnessing and talked to some people from a domestic perspective, and I don't think that really LIV Golf has a lot of life here in the United States. I mean, that you can just look at the ratings, you can look at the fact that they don't really have any commercial business here in the United States as far as partners or sponsors go. So if they are going to find any kind of traction, it's going to have to be globally and internationally. And, you know, I've read the reports about how much money they're trying to generate. And if they do somehow formulate a global schedule, let's just say hypothetically from what I'm hearing, 10 events, I'm just interested in how invested the players are going to be and to play in those events all across the world, you know, with very limited, if any, here in the United States. How invested those players are going to be, especially if it looks to be smaller purses than they're used to playing on LIV Golf.
Well, Rex, this week they do have an event in Korea and Spain the following week, and it is going to be the $30 million purse. That's appealing, obviously, to John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau. In their final tune-ups before the U.S. Open, will their results in these two live events tell you anything about their chances for the year's third major?
Absolutely not. Certainly not when it comes to Bryson DeChambeau. Bryson DeChambeau has played pretty well on LIV Golf this year, and we've seen absolutely nothing out of him at the major championships. John Rahm is a bit of a different conversation, but as he talked about last week, he has found a different way to get ready for majors, and that certainly played off at Aronimink, and I'd like to see what he's going to do at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, we're just a few weeks away from Shinnecock Hills. Before that, golf's longest day a couple Mondays from now. We so appreciate your time, T. Lou and Rex. Thank you so much.
See you, boys.
Well, Damon, yeah, I know that you and I have both downloaded the Golf Channel app, the Golf's Home Anywhere. Download the all-new Golf Channel app today for exclusive access to golf content that you love. Top-notch news coverage from Rex and myself, analysis, and live streaming. Take Golf Channel with you anywhere. More golf today, coming up next. And welcome in to our studios, Ryan Lavner alongside Damon Hack. And look, a lot going on at La Costa today. We have the team leaderboard trying to get the shuffle for the top eight and match play as well. And an individual champion is going to be crowned here
at
the NCAA Championship.
Half hour from now, we'll take you out to Carlsbad. Let's remind the folks what happened last year. You remember the sophomore from Arkansas, Maria Jose Marin, who won the NCAA D1 women's golf individual title. And with the win, she became only the third individual medalist in the history of Arkansas women's golf. Out at Omni La Costa Resort and Spa, we're going to take you there, not just at the bottom of the hour, but how about right now? Because I believe Brently Romine is on site at La Costa. Brently, I know it's one of your favorite times of the year. What should we know about the individual race as you see it?
Well, it's not just one of. It's probably my favorite 2 weeks of the year by far. But look, there's a lot of heavy hitters at the top of this leaderboard, including Catherine Park and Farrah O'Keefe, both entered the day tied for the lead. But with Kathy Park in particular, a little bit of a concern health-wise. She's not 100%. After regionals last Wednesday, she got back. They played in sub-40-degree temperatures, not conducive to the back. So her back injury that she's battled for the last year or so flared up on her. She didn't hit balls for 4 days, but using a push cart for the first time ever this week, and her teammates, luckily they've kept it light for her. They've nicknamed her Hot Wheels, and more seriously, truly incredible to see the growth with her putting mentally since her freshman year when she actually entered the final round of the NCAA championship at Greyhawk, leading by one shot, ultimately fell to Rosang, so a bit of redemption for her. But she'll have to go through Farrah O'Keefe, who I would say is probably the heavy favorite right now to win the Yannicka Award as the National Player of the Year. She's won 3 times this spring. Similar improvement on the greens and mentally for her as well. Of course, we saw her a few weeks ago at the Chevron as well, get low amateur honors there, gained a lot of confidence. And pretty remarkable considering that in high school, coming out of Austin, she had just one offer, and that was from the hometown Texas Longhorns. She accepted that, but kind of a unique player in that she has so many interests. She's done mountain biking, skateboarding. She played stand-up bass in the orchestra growing up, son of a tennis pro. So really well-rounded. And it was a pretty cool story she told me earlier this spring. When she was 11 years old, she wrote a list of goals, about 30 of them, ranging from win a U.S. kids event to buy a big pink truck, win 20 majors. That one might be tough to get to, but also win an NCAA championship, which, of course, she could do this evening if she could check that one off.
Brently, team-wise, we all know the top eight is the all-important number today. Which school do you think is the most surprising contender among that group?
Got to be Iowa State, I think, Lav, considering that this is just their third time ever making the NCAA championship. But the job that Christy Martins has done, the longtime coach there this season, really ask coaches around college golf to tell you that the chemistry within this particular squad, the Cyclonitas, is very close, and players from all over the world. But their motto this year has been, don't get comfy. And this is uncharted territory for them, for sure. high stakes situation, a lot of pressure, a lot of nerves, but they've been doing something that they call urgency practices all year, where they try to get the heart rate up. They run. It's kind of like an obstacle course. They hit shots standing in one leg, just trying to simulate perhaps what their body could do in a moment like this. So I would not count them out. And a bit of synergy between Christy Martins and last year's assistant at Northwestern. Of course, the Wildcats pulled the upset over Stanford. But Beth Miller is the younger sister of Christy Martins. So perhaps older sister can follow little sister's lead and pull off a shocking upset here Wednesday at La Costa.
Brentley, what about a team outside the top eight, left outside in the cold, without a seat at the table, without a spot on the dance floor?
Well, a team outside the top eight, but has already moved inside the top eight and really has the chance to be not only the story of the year in women's college golf, but maybe the story of the decade when you consider Eastern Michigan, when Josh Brewer, the disgraced Georgia coach a couple years ago, took the head job in Ypsilanti. The Eagles were ranked 226th in the nation. They are now 27th. They played in their very first NCAA regional last week, got through that at Nationals for the first time, and pretty crazy to think that they could also make match play for the first time as well this evening. And when you look at their roster, two players will come to mind, and people might think Eastern Michigan, thousands of miles away, this is unfamiliar grounds for them, but they played four of their five events in California. And I mentioned their best players, twins Jasmine and Janae Leoval. Not only are they from Oceanside, also two transfers from Long Beach State, but they still live in Oceanside, California. They've been in Michigan maybe 5 weeks this semester. Pretty crazy, but it's the new model in college golf, I guess, taking all online classes and living on the opposite side of the country.
Brentley, thanks for the time. I know you're going to have great coverage up on golfchannel.com, including a breaking news story with Ryan Hibble, the Oklahoma men's coach, bolting for Georgia Tech. More on that on the website. Appreciate your time.
Back on Golf Today. This week is First Tee Week as we celebrate the impact this organization is making through golf on kids all across the country. Founded nearly 30 years ago, First Tee serves more than 3 million kids annually on golf courses, at schools, and community centers as well. The impact through the three decades, the chapters, the schools, most importantly, the kids and those all-important nine core values. Greg McLaughlin is the CEO of First Tee and joins us now. It's always great to catch up with you. So many of us remember when First Tee was launched some 30 years ago in Central Park. A lot has changed in that time. For you, how has First Tee evolved in your mind?
Hey, good afternoon, Damon. Ryan, happy Memorial Day. So I think the growth has really been incredible over 30 years, and you really have to hand it to Tim Fincham and then certainly the leaders of the USGA, PGA of America, and Augusta National that really helped make it all happen. It really began by just introducing the game to more kids, and then it evolved effectively into life skills and teaching kids about how the game of golf could help them throughout their entire lives, both personally as well as, you know, academically. And we're really seeing that impact after 30 years.
Greg, Dear Coach is the theme this year. Why have you chosen to highlight them in this campaign?
Well, so this is our second year, and we're going to celebrate at the Charles Schwab Challenge for our second year of what we call First Tee Week, where our chapters and really everybody associated with the organization has an opportunity to recognize the impact that the coaches have had. These coaches are mentors. You know, we do an annual study each year with the Harris Group, and the studies effectively come back and they say that young people today really do not have coaches or mentors that are making impact in their lives. And we're proud of the fact that we have 4,000 of these coaches that are not only trained, they're background checked, but they understand effectively the philosophy of what First Tee is and how you can make that connection. There's a tremendous amount of people that like to be coaches and certainly make an impact, but we feel like our coaches make a significant difference because they're trained and they can engage with young people. And I mean, I'd look at you two, and I'm sure the two of you have had a coach in your life at some point that's made a positive impact. And that's really effectively what we're trying to do through our coaches and celebrating First Tee Week and your coach.
Yeah, I definitely have had great coaches.
Love some, fired some. Yeah, certainly.
I was just, by the way, at the First Team Metropolitan New York event at Wingfoot. They're celebrating 25 years of their chapter. And I'm always amazed by the young people, Greg, because they're not just signing up for golf. I mean, they're learning life skills. Can you talk about that aspect? Because I think a lot of people will be confused. Well, my kid's just going to go learn how to hit a pitching wedge. But it's a lot more than that, isn't it?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, the whole foundation of the First Tee was kind of built on these nine core values and really teaching kids how to make those personal connections and how to take what they learn through the game of golf into their everyday life. And whether it's, you know, character development and how you comport yourself in, you know, in various setting or goal settings, which is a big part of it, dealing with perseverance, you know, all the things that golf teaches us, respect for your others, respect for your fellow competitors. And all of those things are now transferring into the classroom. And we're in the process of releasing a University of Virginia study that just came out, a year-long study. And they make a great connection about how our program now connects back to the classroom. So yes, we have a lot of kids that come and they're certainly playing at the collegiate level. Many also play at the high school level. We like teaching them, you know, the game of golf. We'd like them to, you know, carry it forward and play, you know, throughout the rest of their life. But the most important part of it is, I think, the life skills and character development that they're getting through the program.
Greg, I understand that there's a special alumni panel in Fort Worth this week and being hosted by Jim Nantz. What are you hoping comes out of that conversation?
Yeah, so Jim is our honorary chairman. He replaced President Bush 43 last year. And I mean, who better to really draw a distinction on coaches than Jim Nantz, who's literally had a courtside seat around coaches, you know, his entire professional career. And so Jim's going to host a panel. He's, you know, had a great connection with our alumni, participating in a variety of different things week in and week out while he's covering golf for CBS. But we have an alumnus there that's a doctor, a private equity executive, and a current college golfer right now. And I think the connection really for us, you know, 2 years ago, we really made a big investment into our coaches, as we talked about on First Tee Week. But the other thing that we've done really is connecting with alumni. We have some 10 to 15 million kids that have gone through this program in 30 years. And we want to celebrate them and understand really what they're doing and what impact that First Tee has really had in their lives. So again, who better than Jim Nantz to do it? We're grateful to have his support.
Greg, we appreciate it. A few minutes. Give Jim Nantz and the kids our best and have a great First Tee week.
Thank you very much. And thanks to Golf Channel and what you guys have done for us. We're grateful. So very much appreciate it.